Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to After Things, the show we do after Weird Things, where we talk about creativity and all the things that surround it, how to make it a business, how to make it your life, how to make it the way to start your day. Joining me, as always, Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
And, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, Tony B. Cassidy himself, Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, and that's as it has always been, the three of us.
As always, that's how
always the three of us.
The After Things boys.
Hey, before we go into our, we have a weird things question. We have an email, but I had a realization because as we've talked about on the show, you know, having a successful channel in YouTube with Scam School and deciding to start again from scratch with the Modern Rogue, a different property on a different YouTube channel, is a very scary thing. So as a result, you know, I'm not gonna make this generic. I personally am constantly checking the numbers and how quickly we're pulling on new subscribers, how many of our views come from people who are already subscribed versus those that are not. And those are kind of good proxies to figure out if the YouTube algorithm is promoting your content, because basically it figures out, like, okay, people who fit this demographic, who like this kind of show, tend to click play and watch all of these episodes and then fall into this channel. So let me promote them or whatever. And there was this realization that I realized that so much of what I was doing was in the service of trying to, as I put it, please the algorithm. Really what I'm doing is I'm pleasing Google, because ultimately, whether it's a algorithmic decision or a person who just decides, let's make this kid a star, at some level, YouTube is watching how all of your videos do. Mm-hmm. They watch how much of them people watch, and then they decide, let's make this kid a star or not. And specifically for me, like, I had the realization, I couldn't understand why, with the number of subscribers that Scam School had, when we released an episode that was softer, a weaker episode, you know, one that wasn't as good, but had an engaging title and had a good thumbnail, I couldn't understand how preemptively it was as though people knew that ultimately it wasn't going to be a good episode because the numbers would never go up. And then I realized that, of course, what happens is YouTube only shows, it doesn't, when you hit publish, it does not send it to everyone. If you hit the subscribe button, you are not subscribed. You basically have indicated a preference for this type of content, right? And so what it does is it does it in waves. It shows it to a few people. And then based on how many of those people watch it to the end, then it's like, okay, this is a good one. I guess we'll show it to everyone who's subscribed to that. And then it goes on.
But again, you're talking about the recommended on the front page, not the subscription feed.
Correct.
Because I hear that a lot. That is like, YouTube's not sure. It's just because you're the recommended, not talking about the
correct,
subscription
but,
feed.
But yes, and we can acknowledge that the recommended feed is the from what I understand, the bulk of how most people experience and discover and dive into the YouTube black hole. Mm-hmm. But whether I'm wrong on the specifics or not, the significant part for me was realizing that everybody who is – I don't want to say everybody. Some number of the super famous literati of YouTube, you know, the glamorous, the Olympians up there, mm-hmm. They are earned positions insofar as they made content that satisfied Google's preferences for what they want to promote. But at some point, Google decided everybody needs to have this video placed on their plate. Mm-hmm. And it was just a shocking realization to realize, oh, crap, I am an employee of Google, and my job is to make good content. And if I do my job very, very well, they will reward me with a promotion up from you know, assistant manager to manager to regional manager or whatever. And we're in the middle of essentially a promotion where it's like clockwork, the number of new subscribers. And you can see the exact moment that they decide to promote us more and that they decide to promote us less. And it's not based necessarily on I'm sure if you trace it far back enough, the quality of what we're producing affects all that. But right now what I'm seeing is a bunch of people discovering the back catalog of Modern Rogue. And it's the same back catalog that's always been there, but it's very clear that it's somewhere, some AI, some middle manager, whether it's a human, whether it's a robot, somebody flipped a switch and said, I don't know, give these kids a chance. Let's promote them. And there's part of me that despaired at that because I've been doing this for 10 years, and yet I found myself seduced by the fantasy that the quality of the product lives on its own. And it doesn't. Ultimately, we work for Google, and if we're very good employees, they reward us with a marginal bump in promotion.
And beyond that, you don't work for Google. You work for everybody who buys AdSense.
Correct.
And you work for people that buy that. You know, the beauty of Google, what Google offered and in terms of revolutionizing advertising sales was granular, hyper-targeted ability to hit your audience, right? And YouTube was the next step in that of, hey, look, we've now conquered it in terms of search text. Now we'll get into display ads throughout the rest of the internet so we can just feed all these different places. But if you also want video ads and you want this kind of installation, now we are going to offer that on the back of YouTube. But it's all by exactly how they value, they shoots and ladder the money that they get up at the top down to the people that are making the videos. And ultimately what you are doing and guessing, that algorithm is just YouTube asking you, hey, please take all of our money and take all of our views. And you say, okay, how? And they say, whatever they want. And then the negotiation between you and them is your success, because you are creating something now that Google has automated to say, okay, yeah, they're doing that. That appears to be doing well with the other stuff. So we're going to just keep making those connections, and we're going to keep spreading that out, and we're going to keep creating all these webs and networks, and we're going to leverage anytime that we take a risk in throwing it in front of somebody, the billions and billions of times that they take a risk by giving you some sort of front page space or in that algorithm up front, you are now doing better. You are getting better. You are getting closer to the ultimate goal that you make all the money and get all the views. And the better you're able to figure that out, better off you are.
Well, and I guess part of the reason that it really popped in my mind is there's a big shakeup in YouTube over the last, you know, year or so, where they've made a shift away from number of views towards viewer minutes, which means some channels that were heavily promoted are now being less promoted. And of course, a side effect of that is, you know, people who are subscribed who used to always see certain shows, even though they didn't bother to click on them, now they're not even being shown certain shows in the recommended feed, right? Mm-hmm. And what you've gotten is this astonishing outpour of entitlement from folks who had made it to a certain level. And they're all like, YouTube is doing harm to me now. I made it all the way up to here, and I'm entitled to this, and now I can't have it anymore? YouTube, you're a bad person. And I'm so struck by it. It's like, no. You are an employee of YouTube. And yes, you have brought YouTube immense value by creating something that resonates with the public, which is why they promoted you, which is why you're this far ahead. But because you work for them, then they have the right to suddenly stop promoting your stuff or shut down your channel or any of that stuff. And all of that is pretty terrifying.
I mean, it's so different.
Go ahead, Brett.
Yes. To all of that, but that is also the exact positioning if you were a TV show or if you were cable access, whatever.
Great.
It's based on viewership, engagement, and like, you know, the algorithm, yeah, is probably getting rid of Sally's makeup chip channels on recommended, but it's because those people weren't watching it in the first place.
The difference is when I was working for National Geographic, it never once occurred to me that I owned anything and that I wasn't just working for National Geographic. Everybody or many people who have a YouTube channel who reach whatever level of success they have this feeling like it's theirs and they've earned it and they own it. And there's some kind of verbal taekwondo that's causing people to feel an ownership and a right to expression on YouTube that does not exist on television. Because you're right. That was my realization. It's like, there's nothing new about this. We're all still in 1980s. And someone, some fat cigar-smoking guy with a mustache is saying, I don't know, I like this kid. Make him famous. The only difference is it's a fat robot with a robotic cigar and a robotic mustache saying it.
But that robot is using more minute data than a Nielsen law.
Sure. No, no. Bryce, the biggest difference is the amount and size and frequency of the transactions. You know, television networks are always going to be based on, and you are going to be hired and fired and promoted and exalted or defamed based on the fact that at upfronts, you will sell the vast majority of your ad buy for the rest of the year. And you will have to show your results and everything. And that's the biggest thing. This happens every single spring. All the networks go to New York. They all trot out their biggest stars. They wine and dine everybody from GE and Ford and Pfizer. And they make sure that they sign on the line that is dotted for that amount of advertising revenue. That is happening constantly, billions on billions on trillions of times on Google right now. That is always ongoing. And so therefore, where you are hiring executives at a television station to be entrusted to guide that year's worth of money, Google does it algorithmically where it's constantly changing and shifting. And therefore, the notes, quote unquote, which don't really happen because you're not getting communication from YouTube except for watching your numbers, can either be followed or unfollowed just as fast. Mm-hmm. So if all of a sudden you guys found out on Modern Rogue that knife tutorials were the biggest thing ever, you could switch your channel to a knife channel tomorrow, right? And just never do anything but a knife video, and all of a sudden you would experience the success. Where I think Brian's point is interesting is that, you know, nobody likes to get into a Benz and then downshift back to a Kia, right? Like there is just something in human nature and in our way of thinking that just hates going back to a thing that we felt we achieved something by leaving.
Yeah, we are astonishingly loss averse. Like we will pay much, much more to keep a crappy mug we were given than we will pay to buy that same mug.
Exactly. Now, when I was at the Go Game, I was talking to somebody who worked at, I don't want to say which platform, but it's a popular platform. And it was when Patreon was first starting to take off. And I was talking to them about Patreon because obviously we support ourselves on Patreon quite a bit. And they were like, yeah, you know, we as the platform need to get better at giving you what Patreon gives you. You can make more money on here. You can make more money doing this. We really need to be the fact that Patreon is succeeding means that we are failing. And I tried to drill it into their head that as much as any creator, I mean, I think you guys as YouTube creators would love it if you made more money on YouTube, right? And we would love if we made more money on Twitch, and people that are on Facebook would love if they made more money directly from Facebook. But Patreon will always be a great idea, whether or not it's Patreon that does it, because it's not those things. The fact that it's not those things and you have an ability to convert your hardest core fans to a direct payment platform, man, that is worth its weight in everything, right? Like that is the reason why you can afford to take risks with the platforms is the fact that something else exists where you can connect directly.
Yeah. Speaking of which, do you want to talk for a little bit about this? I don't know much about it. I suspect you know more than I do, but
I have not at all read about it other than when we talked about it on the politics thing. So
that's fine, but there's been fallout since then. There was some story, somebody wanted to cover a thing, and Patreon said, we think that your brand of journalism endangers lives, so you're dropped from the platform, and there will be no appeal. Like, this decision is final. I was curious what the fallout was that of that was going to be, and much to my surprise, Within the week, I was listening to the Sam Harris podcast, Waking Up, which, by the way, spoiler alert, that's going to be my pick this week. It's amazing. But he says, hey, this is going to be really inconvenient, but I'm pulling all of my support from Patreon. I don't know this person's politics. I don't really care one way or the other. But I do know that I simply cannot afford to be under the thumb of anyone who can threaten to take away the independence of this podcast. So now, as a direct result of this, the only way to support my podcast will be at samharris.org/support, I assume. I don't know if that's the right one. But I found that astonishing. Somebody who did not have a dog in the fight when it came to the politics, but recognized that, well, now I know that Patreon feels like they're in the business of deciding what is and isn't acceptable, and I could be fired from my own clientele, and that's something I don't want to participate in.
But short of rolling out your own payment processing server, you're always going to be at the mercy of somebody.
Well, yes, but there are some with longer track records, like a PayPal or a merchant services account or a number of cryptocurrency ways to pledge or whatever.
But even PayPal is
sure. Like if it's like, you know, I'll murder whoever you want. Just PayPal me.
Or just adult content. PayPal is, we run into it with the store with certain knives and.
Oh yeah. No, that's like, right. They got a weird thing about knives.
Like unless it, I mean. You're always going to have someone be under someone's thumb unless you're rolling it yourself, and that's
I guess that's the good question. I think that's why I'm so fascinated by this, because where does the line happen? Like, we're all here as independent podcasters and independent creators because we don't like the idea of working for somebody who decides how long we work, what hours, what we say, and then can fire us at any point. But I'm interested in exploring how much of our current position is really just a fantasy based around this idea of independence, and when in reality there's so much that's out of our control and we can be fired and we can have our platforms taken away from us.
Sure. I mean, 100%. And there's a reason why platforms survive and gain credibility, and we think of them as something that is sturdy or of a more rock solid bedrock than others, because it is the absence of these kinds of problems. So for those of you who don't know, Lawrence Southern is the person whose Patreon got pulled. The problem that I had initially when I read the and this is the Daily Caller article specifically, I don't feel like I had a great sense of exactly what happened. So I don't feel that I'm in position to judge anything morally on whether or not Patreon was right or not right to pull it. But the problem that I had with the letter that they sent to her was they didn't cite any specific violation of their TOS, and they didn't if it was not a part of their TOS, they did not push a new TOS that they wanted everybody to sign or force people to abide by if they were going to go forward on Patreon, because that's the only thing that in a world where, you know, all of us derive, if not the majority, a large portion of our income directly through Patreon, that's the one kind of rule of law thing that I would have preferred as somebody who lives in this little town to have had. Is just, if you want to throw her in jail, fine. Just tell me exactly the law she broke.
Because yeah.
That's more where I was like, listen, that's okay. Just let me know what was the statute that she got rung up on.
Well, so the part of that letter there says, quote, "It appears that you are currently raising funds in order to take part in activities that are likely to cause loss of life. We therefore decided to remove your page from Patreon," which is the extent of the details in this letter.
Yeah. Well, and of course, like, the only other side that we're going to get is her side, which may or may not reflect all the things that she suspects that she did. But also, I almost want to steer clear of the specifics on that, because to me, what's more interesting is just the general fact that this is a black and white line that has now been crossed. And now in my mind, I have to think twice about how much I trust Patreon with the finances to. Right. So let me ask you, like, is this the kind of thing that I should be overly concerned about? Like, cross this line, you do not tread. This is a line in the sand.
I mean, no more than I think you already should have been.
Correct. And I guess that's
like, here's the thing, right? And I mean, I've already said it before, but like, unless you are running the servers, running the payment processing, running the video bandwidth, the interconnects on the ISP side, like, unless you actually own and are running the whole apple to apple pie, you're going to be at the mercy of someone. And if the concern is a firestorm, if some political PR nightmare can take me down,
right?
Well, yeah.
Well, and that's the way it's always been.
That's always
right.
How it's been.
Well, and you're right. And I suppose the more charitable way to phrase that
it's
same
only
sentiment
because those ideas can spread quicker, and
more out of your control.
Right.
Yeah. I suppose the more charitable way to phrase essentially the same sentiment would be to say, no matter how you do it, you're going to have to partner with someone. And at some point, any of your partners at any point during anything can decide they don't like what you're doing.
Right.
And they can pull out their part of the partnership. So, you know what? That's not a bad way to put that in mind. I think
because you're trading. What you're doing is you're trading, right? You're saying, I am able to make this content you are able to provide this access or this quality of experience to people. You know, if we got off of YouTube for whatever reason, we could probably take a lot of people to Daily Motion or something else. But
sure,
you also, you know, have to see will the viewers even like doing that? How is that access in their mobile apps and stuff?
I guess that's the thing. Maybe I'm hoping for an untenable fantasy, the idea that independence is truly possible. Because I know certainly I've done my best to diversify everything I can. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Great, we have some people on YouTube, everybody go to Twitter. Great, we got people on Twitter, everybody sign up for the email list or whatever. The idea being, like, I'm so phobic about the idea of being able to be fired from anyone. Not that I'm doing anything terribly controversial or whatever, but
sure.
But anyway, sorry, Justin, you sounded like you had a take right before everything cut out.
Yeah, no, sorry. Forced Skype update. That's great. That's a great thing when it breaks your mic and forces you to update in the middle. No, I mean, I just think, Brian, you deal with this all the time, though. Like, your banks can seize your money. PayPal is constantly. There is a gigantic glittering road of times that they've just totally frozen money for two super specious random shit, you know, that they can justify that others can't. There are a million different ways that your livelihood can be ripped away from you, and that's the reason why I think it's smart to diversify. But, you know, Patreon, right, this shit with Patreon now is important because these are the first challenges that they're going to get. And it's only what happens when OJ opens the Patreon? Like, honestly, that's not even a joke. Like what happens when that happens? What happens when OJ starts his YouTube channel? And is joking about how he killed his wife, right? Like, there's a million different things that are only going to get more thorny and more complicated. And a lot of these platforms that are giving us independence from traditional media and from everything else that has been created, you know, it's not like it's going to go away. You know, it's not like these things are the problems are any different. The difference before is that you had calcified interests that were risk averse, and they made these decisions that were more conservative. Now we have more independent things that can be a little bit more flexible. Doesn't mean they're not going to have to deal with the exact same shit.
Yeah, and even diversifying is a smart idea, especially because it's a mixture of content, it's a mixture of platforms and stuff. But even then, you know, if the concern is one day something blows up, everything's going to blow up on some level. I mean, it's likely less stuff will blow up.
Yeah,
if we're saying that there's a catastrophe,
right,
then
it's very likely that the catastrophe will have negative consequences no matter what platform you're on.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it.
You know, it's also a good perspective to have on that like this is more precarious. This is not a sure thing. This is not
Yeah.
totally safe tunnel.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We did get a question, if you guys have time for
yeah,
a question.
Yeah, dude. Longtime fan of the show, friend of all of us, James Harrison writes in. Our favorite pickpocket in all of Canada writes, so this is a question I hesitate with because it might open up another can of worms or the floodgates, but here goes. What is the right and wrong way to ask for help? Whether it's to ask for money on Patreon or to get a shout out on someone's podcast or even getting people to retweet or share your post. I've asked in the past and gotten both acceptance and help, but also gotten that look of disgust. Like I just asked them something rude and gross. Any tips on the right way to go about this? I have thoughts on this from my days of street performing, but what do you say, Justin?
You know, it's all about your relationship. You know, if you have a very business-like relationship, then it's just going to be a business-like a thing. You know, keep it short, keep it simple, try to get in, try to get out. If it's a friend and somebody that you feel like can do more for you, I would say, you know, it always helps to allow people to have whatever level they want in their help that they can think of, you know. So for Brian, you know, Brian and I are really, really good friends. When we were talking about Action News, it was like, hey, look, I wanted to throw it out as much to Brian as to anything else. And if he had ideas, then I wanted to be there. I wanted to totally take them in and on. And if he's, you know, got a full plate, which he normally does, then I'll be like, hey, look, I'm going to come to Austin. I want to do any and everything that you know, you can offer for me. But it ultimately, there's no hard and fast rule except to say, always have theory of mind. Always put yourself in the other person's perspective and think about not only the fastest, easiest, and least painful way to ask it, but also for it to go on. You know, offering a solution to that kind of stuff is very, very helpful.
So there's three phases. One is, you know, going back to Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, Covey talks about the idea of an emotional bank account. Is there things you can ask that it matters how full or empty your emotional bank account is with that other person, right?
Yeah.
So number one, how much credit do you have with the person you're asking? Number two, how big is your ask? Because there's a big difference between saying, hey, I'm going to need you to join Amway. Don't worry, it's for this huge joke. It'll be really a great payoff at the end.
Right.
And then number three, what is the most efficient use of the other person's time? By which I mean, oftentimes we ask people to do things that aren't remotely what we actually care about. For example, hey, I'm going to need you to tell everyone in your family to vote for me for this contest. Well, if you continue that conversation, it's like, why do you want us to vote for that contest? You're like, oh, well, if I win this contest, it will almost certainly get me more gigs. And we're like, oh, wait, so all of this is because you want gigs? You're like, well, no, I don't even want the gigs. I just have to make rent and I'm $1,000 shy. And then it's like, if you would just get to that last part, if you would have the discussion that takes you there, then the person might say, well, if that's all it is, I've got a charity fundraiser and we need a headliner. I'll give you $1,000 to come do it. You know, and it turns out that you don't care about the votes. Have an honest back and forth dialogue with the other person about and tell the story, because to some degree, in this case, this is couched as how do you ask for something from your fans or your friends? There's really virtually no structural difference between this and the act of selling and advertising.
Sure.
What you want to do is clearly define the benefits to them. And maybe the benefit is you will be personally making a big improvement in my life. You will not. And we talk about this. It's like you're never going to notice the $4 a month when you donate to Patreon, but it will be making a tremendous difference to us. If you feel like there's enough in our bank account to give to you, sure, then by all means do. But also understand that maybe the answer is no. Maybe the answer is, I don't know, I kind of like you guys, but not enough I'm going to give you any money.
When I think at that point you get out of, you know, can you support me for what I already give you for free? It's specifically in the idea of these podcasts and stuff, right? And so one thing I am constantly trying to find the best ways to add is making that additional support have value. Like, not just if you get the podcast and you like it, can you give us, but what else can we give you on top of that?
Sure.
That is economical for us and is something that is really worth it for you. You know, like you, I mean, it sounds really simple, but like for a lot of people, it is a transaction, and they want something, and you could probably give them something, but you got to figure out what makes sense for you and what they actually want.
Well, and from the way I read James's letter, it seems like he wants to avoid getting that face. He says, you know, that look of disgust, like I just asked them something rude and gross. Bad news, bro. That is what it means to put yourself out in the market, to wear your heart on the outside of your body and to say to the world, I hope you think what I've done is of value. Is it?
And then to say no.
Yeah. Welcome to the trials and tribulations of being an independent creator who lives and dies at the whims of people who aren't you.
Yeah. You also just need to understand that there is something that you need to retrain your brain when you're a creator and not a consumer. And part of that is that you are putting yourself out there. You know, it's hard to make a card game. I made a card game. Now I got to sell the card game. Went to Politicon last week, and there was a point when I first started selling it that it would suck. I would investigate everybody's face to see whether or not they were having a good time and whether or not it was good and whether or not they liked it. But that was more about me than it was about them. You know, in general, a lot of times the face that you're talking about isn't even what you think it is. It's confusion 99.9% of the time instead of a registered disgust. Now, sometimes that does happen. So it's like this weekend, we're at Politicon, we're selling the crap out of the game. Every once in a while, you get somebody or you tell them the price, which was very cheap. It was $20 on something that now retails for 25 plus shipping, used to retail for 30. So it's super cheap, and a few people would be like, $20, ugh, too rich. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, that just means that we don't have compatible senses of value. You don't value the game, and if you do value the game, you have a very weird sense of exactly what everything costs in the world, because 500 cards for $20 is a fairly aggressive bargain, unless it's something that is so mass commoditized that it's, you know, something that you've seen a million times. So it's like, all right, we just don't really have a lot to talk about past then. So I don't take it personally. It's just that's where people are at. And that's fine.
I know I can't speak for James, but I know that me personally, every time I'd hear somebody talk that way where it's like, hey man, I'm not offended when people don't like my stuff, I would instantly have this wave of like, oh, teach me. I would love to be that way. I would love to not be affected when somebody actively dislikes what I do. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the way you get it is by just tasting that bag of dog crap enough times that you're like, oh, that's that dog crap flavor. Well,
I bet
it washes out pretty quick.
I bet something that can help with that is recognizing how you react to things that you genuinely don't like. Like that you can respect at a distance, but are not interested in.
Yeah.
And I bet that there is some sort of mental exercise in there of understanding how you go through that process and how other people can go through that process.
Yeah. Right.
Here's the thing. That dog crap taste is your brain recognizing these things that are not necessarily the same thing as dog crap. Believe you me. And Brian, I think you can say this 150%. There has been an evolution. There has to be an evolution in your life if you want to stay sane as a creator, where you have to realize that there's a lot of reasons why people don't like your stuff. And you begin to become, you never stop caring, but you do start understanding that there are a million different flavors of it.
Sometimes yeah. Well, and one of the ways to, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just, I think you're going to probably fill this in. So just as an example, there's like they generally don't like things that are around you, right? That they might confuse you for. There's that they're in a different place in their life, that they don't connect with what you're doing. And ultimately, if you more define that stuff, I think it's easier for you to say like, all right, this isn't just, you know, my every amalgamation of like my grade school teachers and my parents and the first girl I liked who didn't like me back, looking me dead in the eyes and saying, your art is garbage. You'll never be your heroes, which is how we tend to take anything that is not just like, cool, you're making progress at the very least.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a good microcosm of that emotional roller coaster that happens when you start putting stuff out on YouTube and read the unfiltered comments that come in. I wish I could say it was a new phenomenon, but did you end up watching that John Ronson documentary, the Stanley Kubrick's Boxes?
No.
So basically, he died with everything meticulously organized, and basically he's got family members and members of his team that curate all of this stuff. These are all Stanley Kubrick's boxes, and he has boxes and boxes of letters that he would just really quickly scribble crank on the top of, just so he could categorize them, you know, so he knew how serious to take different stuff. And one of the crank letters was like a 3-page thing, just trashing him for, I want to say, The Shining. Let's say it was The Shining. And so John Ronson is like, I'm going to track down this guy. And so he tracks down the guy who writes the crank letter. The guy clearly did not ever remember writing this letter in the 1960s or whatever. Mm-hmm. And clearly was laughing out loud. He was like, wow, what an ass I sound like. There's an asymmetry. And you could see that when you watch the look for the YouTube video from Anything You Want by Derek Sivers, A Real Person A Lot Like You. And it does a good job of just sort of reminding you that this is another human being on the other side. And it's going to be a while till more people than not pause to think, oh, wait, this is a real person a lot like me on the other side of this exchange. And until then, your job, James, is going to be to develop a thicker skin. There's no way better to do that than by taking more abuse.
Now, the other thing I wonder if we can spend a few minutes on sort of the other sort of element of his question, which is not necessarily asking for support and sales and gigs, but like to quote him, to get a shout out on someone's podcast or ask or getting people to retweet and share posts. I know when we do, like we've got the Night Attack Twitter, and every so often when I'll post about a new episode going up, I'll even put at the end, like, please retweet or tell a friend, share or something. Like, you can do little things like that when you know you have an audience where asking something small like that isn't going to cost you anything. Right. I'll do the same thing in the Discord. I'll be like, hey, there's a link to the Twitter.
Or that you know that you have credit to spend. That's the thing, is people try to spend credit that they don't have, right? Mm-hmm. So the answer is... if you want anyone to do anything, the answer is fill their cup first, then say, would you like to do this in reciprocation for what you've gotten out of this before?
Yeah. I think that's the kind of stuff that I still very much wrestle with is just learning to be proactive and connect on stuff sometimes. In terms of even people that I know are cool, because I want to protect, you know, the relationship is something that I do want to protect so much that sometimes I got to force myself out of my element to be like, hey, could you do me a favor and help me hawk my wares for like 5 seconds, you know, like, and I think that's. I don't want to say it's a bad habit because I think it protects the relationship, but it is something that I know where I got to push myself, and I know what element of it feels unnatural, yeah. You know, and that's what you always just keep in mind.
Well, I think it only feels unnatural if you suspect that you're asking somebody with an empty cup to do more, like that. That's where things get weird.
No. I mean, I would say. For me, I could do 9,000 things for somebody and have one favor that I want, and I will agonize over asking that favor. Mm-hmm. Like I will wonder whether or not I am crossing a line on that thing, and it will always feel unnatural to me until I hit send on the DM or the email or the text message or something, and I get a response back.
Right.
You know. It's that will always feel weird for me, no matter how much I do, no matter how many times. But that's, listen, if you ever wonder why my Twitter feed is very often this patchwork of all my friends' things and projects, and I know I can be guilty of over whoring not only my own stuff, but also my friends' stuff. It's because I know that, like, I want that. I hope that what you're saying, Brian, will eventually be true for me. That at some point I'll look into the Scrooge McDuck vault of things that I have done, and I'll say, okay, I can ask for one thing back.
Oh, and yeah.
It always, always 100% feels not bad, but unnatural. I need to push myself out of a zone to do it.
Well, and one of the ways that I could do it, because I too am uncomfortable asking people to do a thing, but I am not uncomfortable saying, hey, just so you know, this is the situation I'm in. This is the situation that this is what I would like to have happen. And on a scale of 1 to 10, this matters to me a 9 out of 10. So if you feel like it's a match for you to do that, then it would be very much appreciated. But I understand I'm fine if you don't want to do it or whatever. Like that kind of factual reporting and handing it in their hands, I find easier because it's not me, you know, because you're a sovereign individual. I don't get to tell you what you do and don't do with your account or whatever. But what I can do is accurately report how I feel about this opportunity, how big an impact you can have, and what the most effective thing you can do to help me out. So that's my answer to you, James.
Cool.
Yeah, James.
Time for quick picks.
Yeah, quick picks. Listen to "Waking Up" by Sam Harris. It's a great podcast. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. What's the 1 second like?
Sam Harris is an outspoken critic of a lot of things, but he has an astonishing interview style that is so above cheap shots. He's much more concerned about ideas. There's a fascinating debate between him and Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, and the two of them have very different takes on the Trump presidency. And yet, you know, it begins with very much a meeting of minds and a setting of rules and an insistence that it be a discussion of ideas, and that there was zero cheap shots the entire way through. And when I listen to Sam Harris debate, it makes me want to elevate my ability to have discourse with other people.
Awesome. Justin?
I am going to pick...
I can go if you need a second.
Yeah, go. You go.
Okay. Netflix just put out their second season of Last Chance U, and it's really cool. The first season is very much like, what does it look like for a junior college football team that gets troubled athletes and troubled but high school athletes and goes on and wins these national competitions? What does that look like? And the second season, which just came out, is actually a neat twist in that all of the people in it have seen the documentary and know how they're responding. And
people
have sort of this response to that whole year. And some of them are very fed up, and some of them are actively trying to act differently to be a better person, or so on. And
are these really the same players that we saw the first year?
So no, it's mostly new football players, but the staff is very much the same. So it's the same coach, same academic advisor.
Oh, got it. But they're a little more savvy.
Like it begins with this you've got the coach buddy who's like, I saw the documentary and I didn't like the things that I said and da da da, and so I'm gonna try to be better. And you see him like, you know, oh, I'm doing push-ups anytime I curse at the kids and all this stuff. And then as the season goes on and the pressure and the stakes go on, you see how that pressure applies to someone who knows that they're being watched, which I think is really fascinating. And spoiler alert, season 3 is about to start filming and it's going to be a different school.
Interesting.
Which is, yeah, a weird sort of take on that.
Cool. My pick is the We Are All Gonna Die podcast from The Daily Dot. I was on it a couple weeks ago, and they are great guys out there. Big shout out to The Daily Dot and The Daily Dot's Facebook page. They helped us tremendously on Action News. And by the way, Action News is done on Wednesday. So if you want it, get it now.
Holy cow. Awesome. Wait. So Wednesday, you mean we have, 48 hours if you want to get in?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I waited until literally I have to go in like 30 seconds to talk about it. So,
okay. All right. Action News, it's the best. You guys are the best. It's been after.
Bye.
Bye. The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.